This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a pretty fascinating culinary source pack for you today. And I have to say, if you search the internet right now for Korean noodles, the algorithm is going to instantly bombard you with like very intense videos.
Oh, yeah. People sweating, crying.
Literally crying, desperately chugging milk. We have all seen those viral, fire-breathing, spicy noodle challenges.
Yeah, it's become this massive internet stereotype.
It really has. It positions this entire culinary category as, you know, a test of extreme endurance. But the source material we're looking at today introduces a dish that just completely shatters that stereotype.
It really does. It's cold. It's remarkably mild, and supposedly you can make it in about 25 minutes.
Which is wild. And that's exactly why this specific source document is so fascinating to dig into.
Yeah, because what we're looking at today isn't just a recipe card that you'd find on a random food blog. It is essentially this cultural architectural blueprint.
A blueprint. I like that.
Right, because it was designed specifically to help home cooks outside of Korea understand and physically recreate this dish called bibim nakmyeon.
And officially, that falls under the broad category of Korean noodles.
Exactly. But the creators of this guide, they clearly knew that just saying Korean noodles wouldn't mean much to someone standing in a kitchen in, like, Ohio or Madrid.
No, they anticipated that disconnect perfectly. Because right at the top of the document, they provide a really strategic search hint for English speakers, which is just spicy cold noodles.
Which simplifies it so much.
It does. And they even include the Spanish translation, fideos, frios, picantes. I just find that detail so telling, you know?
It immediately signals that they're actively thinking about a global audience.
Yeah.
They know people are trying to wrap their heads around a culinary concept that might feel totally alien to them.
Right. It's not just a U.S.-centric thing. And I want to focus on that alien concept idea for a second. Because usually when we picture a comforting bowl of noodles for dinner, the comfort is entirely tied to heat.
Oh, definitely. You imagine steam rising off a rich broth.
Exactly. Curling up into your face on a rainy winter night, we have this deep, almost evolutionary association between hot food and safety or coziness.
For sure.
So taking that entire steaming hot framework and flipping it into something cold and refreshing, I mean, it's kind of the ultimate summer culinary plot twist.
It is a deliberate act of cultural translation. Unlike a standard recipe that just gives you yields and ratios, you know, add this much salt, boil for this many minutes, this guide is functioning as a bridge.
A bridge to teach you the philosophy of the food.
Exactly. It outlines exactly what this dish is, the context of when you're supposed to eat it, and crucially, the structural traps you need to watch out for.
Especially when you're attempting to cook it thousands of miles away from its origin. But, okay, I do have to push back on the prep data in the source because it creates a bit of a paradox for me.
How so? I mean, the data seems incredibly straightforward.
Well, the guide officially rates the difficulty level as easy, and it estimates the total cooking time at only 25 minutes.
Yeah, 25 minutes.
That is exactly my point. If this document is meant to be a master guide for a deeply authentic cultural touchstone, how can it only take 25 minutes?
I see what you're saying.
Because usually when you're trying to replicate the bedrock dishes of any global cuisine, you're talking about hours of simmering. You're developing complex flavor profiles over an entire afternoon.
Right, right.
So how does an easy 25-minute dish hold up as a serious culinary experience?
That is a very valid skepticism. And it brings us right to the mechanics of how this dish actually works.
Mm-hmm.
The 25-minute prep time is possible. Precisely because the dish doesn't rely on the slow extraction of fats.
Like the fats and collagens you'd find in a hot bone broth?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Instead, it relies on the immediate, sharp interplay of composed sauce and the physical texture of the noodles. And this is where that spice level becomes critical.
Because it cuts right through the viral internet noise we were talking about.
Yes. The spice level for bibim nakmyeon is explicitly categorized in the guide as mild.
Mild. Not a dare, not a stunt food. Just, well, mild.
Exactly. And when you look at the biology of how we perceive flavor, extreme heat, like aggressive capsaicin, actually numbs the palate.
Oh, wow. So it actually masks nuance.
It does. If you're serving a cold dish meant for summer refreshment, you don't want to blast the palate with a weaponized level of spice.
Yeah.
The mild spice here is calibrated to stimulate the appetite on a hot day, not overwhelm your nervous system.
And because you aren't blasting the palate with heat, you basically can't mask poor ingredients. You actually taste everything.
Every single component.
You taste the noodle, you taste the subtle notes in the sauce, which makes it even more surprising that they've stripped out what a lot of home cooks rely on as their main flavor crutches.
Yeah, the dietary profile of this dish is completely devoid of the usual suspects.
It is remarkably stripped down. According to this guide, it explicitly states that this dish contains absolutely no pork, no beef, no chicken, and no seafood.
Which is pretty rare for such a staple dish.
It is. And furthermore, while they don't give a comprehensive allergen chart, the guide firmly confirms that a vegetarian alternative is a definite yes.
Right.
But wait, no seafood at all. Not even like fish sauce hidden in the background. Because my brain automatically assumes any complex East Asian sauce is going to have some kind of fermented seafood paste, providing that umami base.
The document is definitive on this. Zero seafood. And if we look at the logistics of why the creators of this guide would emphasize a meat-free, seafood-free profile, it ties directly back to their primary goal of overseas accessibility.
Oh, sure. Think about the global supply chain for an average home cook.
Right. It's one thing to find a bottle of soy sauce or sesame oil in your local supermarket.
But finding a highly specific cut of meat or, you know, a regionally specific type of clam is a totally different ballgame.
Precisely. When a recipe relies on the terroir of local Korean agriculture, like a specific breed of pork or fresh seafood from a specific coastal region, the moment a cook in London or Buenos Aires tries to replicate it using their local supermarket equivalents, the dish mutates.
The flavor profile changes entirely because the foundational proteins are just different.
Exactly. So by bypassing meat and seafood entirely, the creators have engineered a dish that is globally stable. The barrier to entry drops significantly because you aren't fighting your local supply chain.
You know, it's almost like they designed open source software.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, you don't need a highly proprietary, expensive operating system, meaning like a specific, hard to find cut of meat to run the program.
Right, you just need the basic code.
Exactly, the basic code, which is the sauce and the noodle. And it will run perfectly on almost any hardware in any kitchen in the world. It is an incredibly inclusive way to share food with people.
It really is.
I mean, you could host a dinner party with a vegetarian, someone who avoids pork, and someone who hates fish, and you only have to cook one meal.
The open source analogy is actually perfect here. Because just like software, if the underlying code is sloppy, the whole program crashes. Since the dish is meat-free and only takes 25 minutes, there is absolutely nowhere for bad technique to hide. You can't rely on a rich, 24-hour braised short rib to distract your dinner guests from the fact that you messed up the noodles.
Which totally explains why an easy dish comes with such intense academic instructions. The guide places a massive emphasis on what we can basically call the pillars of execution.
Yes, the core mechanics.
It mandates that anyone learning this dish must focus heavily on the core ingredients, the target taste, and the texture. And it specifically flags frequently made mistakes alongside oversized cooking alternatives.
And that focus on texture over everything else is what trips up most casual cooks. Because when you serve food cold, the laws of culinary physics literally change in your mouth.
Okay, wait, how so?
Well, heat volatilizes aromatic compounds. That's why hot food smells stronger and often taste richer. Cold temperatures actually mute certain flavor receptors on our tongue.
Interesting.
But in exchange, cold hyper-amplifies our perception of texture.
Okay, let's break that down mechanically for our listeners. What does that actually look like for you, standing at your stove boiling these noodles?
Think about the starch in the noodle itself. When you boil any noodle, it releases starch into the water, creating a sticky, gelatinous layer on the outside of the noodle.
Right.
In a hot bowl of ramen or pho, that surface starch just washes away into the hot broth, and it slightly thickens the soup in a very pleasant way.
Oh, sure. But in a cold, brothless dish like bibim nangmyeon, the mechanics have to be totally different. Because there is no hot liquid to wash it away.
Exactly. You are just pulling the noodles out of the water. And if you don't vigorously rinse those noodles under freezing cold water the second they finish cooking, that residual surface starch acts like super glue.
So they just clump into a giant ball.
Pretty much. Okay. Furthermore, as starch cools down, it undergoes a process called retrogradation. It literally crystallizes and stiffens.
Oh, wow.
So if you overcook the noodle by even 60 seconds, it gets mushy. But then when you chill a mushy noodle, it doesn't get firm again. It just becomes a cold, gummy, unappetizing paste.
Yikes.
And alternatively, if you undercook it, the cold temperature turns it into a rubber band. The margin for error on the physical bite of the food is incredibly slim.
So the 25 minutes you spend making this dish aren't passive minutes at all. You aren't just walking away while a pot simmers.
Right.
You're actively managing the physical state of the starch. You have to nail the exact moment of doneness and instantly shock it with cold water to lock the texture in place.
It requires intense focus, yes. And this scientific reality is why the document section on overseas cooking alternatives is so vital.
Right.
They know that a cook in another country might not be able to find the exact brand of Korean buckwheat or sweet potato starch noodles traditionally used, but they can't just let the home cook blindly guess what to use instead.
Because if someone thinks, oh, I don't have Korean noodles, I'll just use Italian angel hair pasta or a regular wheat spaghetti because they look roughly the same shape, the entire dish just collapses.
It collapses completely. Italian wheat pasta has a completely different protein and starch structure. It doesn't have the chewy, elastic bounce required for bibim naengmyeon.
And doesn't it also affect the sauce?
Yes. The sauce for this dish is generally a thick, cohesive paste. If you use the wrong noodle, a noodle with the wrong surface friction, the sauce will either slide right off and pool at the bottom of the bowl, or it will clump up and become cloying.
Man, it's like replacing a load-bearing wall in a house. You can't just swap a wooden beam for a piece of drywall just because they're both painted white.
That's a great analogy.
You have to swap it for something that holds the exact same amount of weight, or the roof caves in. In this dish, the specific elasticity of the noodle is the load-bearing wall.
Exactly.
The substitutions they provide aren't just about swapping a flavor. You are literally swapping physics. You have to maintain the structural integrity of the bite.
That is precisely what the creators of the guide are trying to ensure. They are preempting the most common structural failures. They are perfectly fine with you using an approved local alternative, provided that alternative maintains the architecture of the dish.
Right. They want you to experience what it actually feels like to eat bibim naengmyeon, not just what it looks like on a plate.
Yes. That level of care is honestly incredible. It shows that they deeply respect both the dish itself and the person trying to make it.
They really aren't gatekeeping the culture by saying, if you can't find this exact brand of imported noodle, don't even bother. They're giving you the tools to succeed with what you have, as long as you respect the science of the texture.
It's a masterclass in how to export culture effectively. You distill the essence of the dish down to its absolute non-negotiables in this case. The cold temperature, the mild spice, the specific mouthfeel.
And you give the user the flexibility to build around those pillars. So, synthesizing everything we've decoded from this master guide today for you, bibim naengmyeon, is basically the ultimate counter-narrative to the viral internet spicy noodle trend.
It really is.
It's a highly accessible 25-minute dish. It relies on a beautifully mild, balanced sauce that cools you down rather than, you know, setting your palate on fire.
Right.
It requires absolutely no meat or seafood, making it globally stable and incredibly inclusive for different dietary needs. And it trades the traditional wintry comfort of hot broth for the sharp textural precision of a cold summer dish.
It proves that complexity in cooking doesn't always require hours of time or rare expensive proteins.
Very true.
Sometimes complexity is just about managing temperature and texture perfectly.
It really does prove that. But before we wrap up this deep dive, there is one final highly specific instruction in this source pack that we absolutely have to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
It's directed at the people writing the guide, and it is honestly my favorite detail in the entire document. The directive is incredibly blunt. It just says, do not invent history. Do not make medical claims.
It is a phenomenal inclusion, and it highlights a pervasive issue in how global food is usually marketed to the West. The creators of this document are actively rebelling against an entire industry of culinary exoticism.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about how often a foreign ingredient or a traditional dish is sold to us with this heavily romanticized, almost mystical origin story.
Right. This ancient grain was guarded by monks on a misty mountain for 3 millennia.
Exactly. And we eat that stuff up.
We do, because marketers know that consumers often feel they need a narrative justification to step outside their culinary comfort zone. Either the food has to be a magical historical artifact, or it has to be a superfood.
We're constantly sold the idea that eating a specific exotic berry or a certain type of fermented tea is going to, like, cure inflammation, boost your immune system, and reverse aging.
Yes. It is the gimmickification of global food. We are conditioned to need a magic potion. So when a cultural body explicitly forbids their own writers from inventing history or promising medical miracles, it sends a massive message.
It communicates supreme, unwavering confidence in the actual product.
They are essentially stating, we do not need to invent a fairy tale to convince you to eat this.
Right.
We do not need to promise that this mild, cold noodle dish will cure your ailments. The physical reality of the food, the taste, the texture, and the sheer joy of executing it properly in your own kitchen is completely sufficient.
You're saying the food is good enough to stand entirely on its own merits without all the marketing fluff. It's a wonderfully grounded, honest approach to sharing their culture.
It really is.
It takes that whole idea of the steaming, cozy bowl of noodles we started with and proves that you don't need heat, you don't need meat, and you certainly don't need an ancient marketing myth to create something deeply satisfying.
It invites the home cook to engage with the food as it exists today, in reality, rather than as a caricature.
Which leaves us with something fascinating to consider. The next time you are standing in your kitchen, maybe tonight, open up your pantry. Look at the specialty items, the imported sauces, the trendy grains you've purchased over the last few months. How many of those items did you buy because you were sold a story, a history, or a health promise? And how many did you buy purely for the structural integrity of the food itself? Something to think about.
This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.